Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Each week, we try to remind you that no matter where you live in this wonderful country of ours, there are heroes in your hometown. No matter where that hometown is, there are people around you, men and women, who've been willing to put their lives on the line for the sake of our freedom, many times giving up their own freedom for long periods of time, as is the case today with a former prisoner of war in Las Vegas, Nevada, Dean Whitaker, 86 years old, originally from California, my guest today. And Dean, you grew up in Southern California. I imagine that's where you were on December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that Sunday?
Well, I was working in a gas station Sunday morning, and I didn't know anything about it. And somebody come driving in and said, "Did you hear the news?" I said, "No." Is it Japan attacked Pearl Harbor? And that was quite a thing to me, because I was that age. Pretty soon I was going to join the service. I was a senior in high school, and the day continued, and people would drive in, and most people were kind of mad. And as the day wore on, I heard more and more about what was going on, and it was quite thrilling.
Yeah, it seems like a very interesting place to get the news. And this is in Maywood, California, where you grew up. I imagine a lot of people that pulled in to get their tanks filled up maybe had just heard on their car radio, or maybe even hadn't heard yet, and that was probably the only thing you guys talked about.
That's right. And, you know, gasoline was selling for 10 cents a gallon then. That was the cheapest, and it went clear up to 15, 18 cents a gallon. And that was when times were really good.
You know, I've talked to some other people who were in Southern California, I guess a little closer to the coast, like Long Beach area at that time, who, when they heard the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, they were ready for the Japanese to attack L.A. that night, and they were out there looking for for enemy. Did you have any concern that California might come under attack? Was that something you thought of?
Oh, yes. We had air raid signs. I think the balloons had come over, and we had heard the sirens going off in Long Beach, and we thought, my goodness, you know, what's going to happen here? Anything.
So you were ready to do something about it?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I was ready. And like I say, I was in high school, and I had three friends that we all wanted to join the Air Corps because they had these nice uniforms, and it sounded really good. So we went down to the old Pacific Electric building in L.A. and signed up. And luckily, I had taken a college course in high school, and I passed the exam for aviation cadet. The other fellas weren't that lucky, but they went in as aerial gunners. The four of us that went in, I was the only one that returned. Thank goodness I made it. But I'd go to a high school reunion and have no friends.
Well, that's the reality of the time that you lived in and the time that you served. So you wanted to be a pilot, I take it?
No, I didn't care what I made. I just wanted to be a aviation cadet. And I went through Santa Ana Air Base at classification, was classified for either one, pilot, navigator, bombardier. And it just happened that they had the bombardier school was open, and they're going to start at Victorville. And I thought, boy, Victorville, you know, I can commute to home. And it was a short course. I think it was 18 weeks I'd be a second lieutenant. So I said, I'll take that. And but they got to the W's, and that class was full, so they shipped me off to Kingman, Arizona, to gunnery school to wait for the next class. So I went through Kingman, Arizona, got my gunner's wings, and the class was ready to start in Victorville, but they had changed that to bombardier navigator, and it took an additional 6 weeks, so I didn't make it. I was very fortunate there, because the fellows that I was at Santa Ana with a classification got into B-26s and A-20s which were known as flying coffins, and I had heard that a lot of those were those fellows were killed. So I was fortunate there that I did get to go to B-17s.
Do you remember the first time you went up in a B-17 and what kind of thrill that was for you?
Oh, yes, that was quite a thrill for an 18-year-old just graduated from high school at Kingman, Arizona. We got into B-17, I think there was about 10 of us, and we took off and we're flying, and I thought, boy, this is great. And we were flying at treetop level, and all of a sudden we were just flying along, and the ground just dropped out from underneath us. We were went over the Grand Canyon, and what a sight, having the ground disappear, and here you're flying up in the air. It was wonderful.
Some great memories, clearly. And I'm sure, though, in the back of your mind, there was probably this sense of, I want to get over there and do something pretty soon. Enough of this training stuff. When am I going to go do what I signed up to do?
Yeah, at the time, we were just starting class, and I thought, well, let's hurry up and get this class done. I did real good at the gunnery school because my dad had been quite a hunter, and we went hunting. I had my first 22 rifle from old Sears and Roebuck there in Los Angeles when I was 14 years old, and I'd go hunting with that, and he had all kinds of guns, and my brother did. So when I went to gunnery school, they handed me a 45 caliber pistol to see if I could hit the target, and I amazed the instructor, because I had shot in my dad's 32 automatic, and I just blasted that hole out of the center of that target. And he says, you've been doing this before, haven't you? I said, yeah, I've been shooting guns since I was 12. So anyway, at Kingman, I was the head of my class. I had my name put out on the bulletin board when I graduated. And I graduated and got a set of wings, which came in handy when I had visits to Los Angeles when I was in Kingman.
Came in handy how? Spell that out for us.
Well, you know, I was an 18-year-old second lieutenant, aviation cadet, and had a nice uniform, and I had quite a few dates in high school from there.
So those wings worked their magic for you. Pretty soon those wings would take you overseas with the 398th Bomb Group. Do you remember what it was like to head overseas thinking, well, pretty soon this is going to be real, no more practice, no more fooling around shooting at targets, this is the real deal?
Yes, England was being experienced a lot of bombing then, and luckily when we got there, they were all the buzz bombs, and not many bombers were flying over. But it was a thought that, you know, we are now in a danger zone, and we're going to be lucky to come out of this. And at the railroad station, when we were getting ready to go to our base, there was a lot of flyers there that had flown quite a few missions, and they had their medals on, and they really looked great. I said, boy, I sure hope I make this. And so when we arrived at the base, I thought, well, at least they have kind of a good facilities. We had tents that had wood sides on them, and we lived fairly comfortable there.
And by this time, had you started to form a bond with the guys that you'd be flying with? Was your crew able to stay together?
Yes, our crew stayed together. We had our training in Rapid City, South Dakota, where we met our crew and did some flying and bombing around there, practice bombing. And so we got overseas. We were all very well acquainted with each other. And we had one accident on takeoff where we hit a tractor when we're taking off. This is when we were learning how to group, to fly with the group. We hit this tractor and crashed through a bunch of trees at the end of the runway. And we all got out all right. The plane burned up, and I have pictures of that. But one of the tail gunners, the plane broke in half, and he was burnt pretty bad, and he spent the rest of the war in the hospital. But this was over, and they put us back in an airplane the next day so we wouldn't get afraid to do that. And so we continued right away in our first mission.
Holy moly. I know that you lived through that and you've described it a time or two since then, but I'm picturing myself in that situation. And that sounds pretty hair-raising to me. Where were you on the plane, and how did you experience that crash with the tractor?
I was up in the nose, and it was very scary, I'll tell you, having see that tractor coming up. The fella operating the tractor, when he jumped off of it and run, I thought, man, we're in trouble. And actually, the nose didn't hit it. The wheel hit it. But when we hit the trees, the nose disintegrated, and the plexiglass was flying, and I had no trouble getting out of the plane because there was no nose. I just went right out with the navigator that was with me. And we hit the dirt right away because the 50 caliber shells were going off and just buzzing all over the place. And, you know, they can do some damage when they're going off. So as soon as the fire crew got there from the base, they took us back to check us out. Nobody was hurt except the gunner.
That sounds like a close enough call to me. I mean, that could have been absolutely disastrous for you and for everybody there. And, you know, you hit on being in the nose, and maybe we should paint that picture for listeners. On a B-17, tell us about how many men you have on the crew and where your position was, because you end up with a pretty interesting view on everything.
Yes, being up in the nose, you knew just exactly what was going on at all times. Now, when we were flying a mission, we'd get in clouds and all over the place, and it was a very pretty picture. And it was really nice when you're flying in a big group, the contrails from the planes, what the planes made, were quite eerie. It just lighted up the sky. The place I had as a bombardier was the front seat right by the, there was a turret there, and the bomb sight was right between my legs. It wasn't very large, and the navigator sat behind me. He had a table, a navigation table, and later on when we were flying, they took our navigator to another crew when they learned that I had taken navigation training too, and they made me the navigator. And so I changed positions. I sat at the table, and I had a nose gunner up at the nose with me. He fired every shot, and just we didn't have much experience. All of our attacks were from the rear, and the nose gunner wasn't very busy, but he was there to do if he had to.
Well, let's move on to your first mission, because I understand this was a fairly eventful mission, trial by fire, and I guess you got trial by fire before you even flew a mission with that crash with the tractor. But your first mission, you ended up with a Purple Heart after it. So tell me what happened on that first mission. This was right after D-Day?
Yes, it's right after D-Day when we were trying to make a breakout from the German lines. The Germans had a lot of firepower there, and I don't know if who... I guess Eisenhower requested Air Force help, so we went in at a low altitude. We usually flew at about 28,000 feet. On this mission, I think it was at 5,000 or so feet, and every gun German had, it was shooting at us. I could see the flashes from the ground of them shooting at us, and we knew exactly when we flew over enemy lines when all this flashing started. And we were getting hit once in a while. I could smell it every time we got hit, the burning of the material against the aluminum. And this happened quite a bit. We dropped our bombs and turned around, and the plane next to us got hit real bad, and it exploded, and nobody got out of that. And it was quite a sight. It lasted me quite a while. But on the way back, we went over the lines, we got hit again. The instrument panel in the plane and the nose got shot out, and the hydraulic line from the controls is red, and we had this red come all over us. And the navigator that was up with me thought he was shot. He saw, oh my gosh, this red is coming out of my chest. Well, he rubbed it and found out that it was hydraulic fluid, so he felt great. But in the meantime, when the nose got shot out, I had a face full of plexiglass, and I could hardly see. and it was burning really bad. So we got back to the base, and they took me to the base hospital, cleaned my eyes out, and in the following few days, my eyes were swollen shut, and so I was off line duty for 2 weeks. And as soon as they healed, I could see again, I was back. I think I missed just one mission because of that. But in those days, you know, it wasn't unusual for someone to get hit like that. And the commanding officer of our base was killed on the next mission, so he had no way to report anything. No Purple Hearts were given. I was visiting the VA here just a year or so ago, and the doctor asked me if I ever received, if I was ever damaged in any of the missions. I told him about my eyes. He said, "Did you get the Purple Heart?" I said, "No." He said, "You're going to get that for you." Well, he did. And 60 years later, I received the Purple Heart at the air base, in, at Nellis Air Base.
What did that mean to you after all those years to receive that medal and everything that comes with it?
Well, it was an honor for me because I had received the air medal with a couple Oak Leaf clusters and had a few other medals. But the Purple Heart, it is a special medal.
And another special one is the Prisoner of War Medal, an even more exclusive group that I know you're going to share with us about that. I don't want to dwell on this too long, but again, you described that because you lived through it, but the rest of us didn't. And I'm curious, when that happens, when the nose of your B-17, which you're sitting in, by the way, gets shot out, and the plexiglass ends up in your face, and you can't see, and you don't know if you're going to make it home on that mission, you don't know if you're ever going to see again, what goes through your mind? I mean, how did you get through that experience, and what maybe kept you focused in believing that you would be okay?
Well, it was a terrible situation because the plane had gotten hot pretty bad. One engine was out, and one engine was feathering, and we weren't making much headway. And I thought, boy, we'll be lucky to get back to base. But, you know, the Lord is with me, and that really helped.
Amen to that. And I think through the rest of your story, we're going to see that as well. I have to ask you, if you had a nearly fatal crash before you ever flew a mission, and then you got hit in the eyes and couldn't see after your first mission, were you a little hesitant to go on more missions after that?
You know, being an 18-year-old kid, you really are kind of fearless. You think, well, somebody's got to make it out of this, and I'm going to be the one. And you have that attitude that it's kind of a devil-may-care attitude, and you don't scare that easy.
Well, I can see that about you. Dean Whitaker, our guest today, 86 years old. He lives in Las Vegas, Nevada. And when we come back, we're going to get more of his stories, the missions after that first one in the B-17, and the mission that would be his last over Europe during World War II. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. You know, with the WAC basketball tournament in Las Vegas this week, I took advantage of being there by visiting with Dean Whitaker, 86 years old, of Las Vegas, Nevada. He's a former prisoner of war. He was a bombardier and also navigator on B-17s during World War II with the 398th Bomb Group. And the plane that you guys were flying, that your crew occupied, Dean, was called Stormy Weather. And I understand on one mission in particular, it really lived up to that name.
Yes, we were flying at 88,000 feet, and it gets pretty cold up there, and we were flying through some clouds that had snow in them, very moist, and a B-17 is a kind of a rattly airplane as far as comfort concerned, and it gets very cold there. Well, the snow was coming through the cracks of the nose, and it piled up a little bit, and the navigator gathered up a snowball and threw it at me. And to this day, he still kids me about having a snowball fight at 28,000 feet.
Not too many people in the world can claim that, I don't think.
No, probably not. It was kind of unusual, but we always kept our sense of humor, and that no matter what was going on, we were scared, of course, but we didn't show it.
I'm thinking probably the only other people that have had a snowball at 28,000 feet would be maybe like Sir Edmund Hillary or someone who climbed Mount Everest, huh?
Yes, you'd have to get pretty high and it's pretty cold to do that.
By the time your 20th mission rolled around on November 2nd, 1944, you had probably gotten into a bit of a groove with your crew and you guys had found some kind of routine to going up on a mission, coming back, and believing that's the way it was going to work. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yes. Our pilot was an older guy. He was really a good man. He was 26 years old, and he was a first lieutenant. He had made first lieutenant in the infantry and got to join the Air Force at a later date. I don't know. He probably had a lot of medals or something to make that. But he was really kind of a religious guy, too. We would always meet under our plane before a mission, and everybody say a little silent prayer. And this helped.
I believe it, and I imagine, you know, that's different for every person in the military, but it sounds like maybe that had been a part of your life growing up, that you had some awareness or relationship with God or some kind of belief that was going to help you there?
Yes, my parents were Mormons, and we always had that feeling that if we needed help, it was there.
Well, and I think the story we're about to dive into will certainly show that. Tell me about that mission. You're supposed to bomb Merseburg on November 2nd, 1944?
Yes, their synthetic oil plant at Merseburg was a major target. The Germans were running out of oil in their tanks, and that just didn't have enough to really put out a full effort. And so this target was very special. I think every gun in Germany was at that plant. They'd taken them all from Berlin, and the Air Force was the Luftwaffe was the only place they flew was Merseburg, and it was quite a battle. When I looked ahead and saw the flak, which is the black explosion of 88 millimeter shells going off, I thought, Mike, we're going to be lucky to get through this. And we got through it fine. We were hit a few times. I could tell when you were hit that we could smell the burning hot flak metal going through the ship, and we got out of that fine. And as soon as we were out of that, the Luftwaffe attacked us. The first attack, they always attack from the tail because their 20 millimeter cannon would go further than our 50 caliber machine gun, and so the tail gunner was really busy on that first mission, and I think he shot down one of the planes. One of the fellows said, you got one, over the intercom. And so on the second attack, we were hit really bad. The tail gunner was shot bad. And the waist gunner went back to check on him, and he did. He said, he's dead. By that time, we were hit real bad, and the plane was out of control. The pilot gave the word to bail out, and me being the navigator, right by the nose escape hatch, I was the first one out. On the way, before I could go out, I had to release. I wore what they called a flak suit, armor vest, and I couldn't. There's an escape tag on that that you pull, and it's supposed to be released. Well, it didn't release, and I was fighting that, trying to get that off, and I said, man, I got to get out of here. And, you know, I had a voice kind of. My father had passed away about 8 months before I went in the service, and I thought I heard his voice say, you get out of there now. So I did. I wanted to jump out. I said, I can't wait any longer. I jumped out of the escape hatch of the nose, and as soon as I hit the slipstream, it tore the flak suit off, but my parachute was only fastened on one side because I couldn't fasten the other side when the flak suit was on. So here I was fighting all the way down, trying to fasten the other side. And at 28,000 feet, you have no strength. You're just ready to pass out. And so I started entering some clouds at 3,000 feet. And I said, well, I better pull this now, whether it's fastened or not. And I pulled it, and I was floating down, and I could hear shots coming up at me. And the Germans were shooting at me as I was coming down.
And this was fire from their aircraft or from the ground?
Well, that was from the ground. It was civilians in the ground were shooting. They all had guns. And then the odd thing about this, when I was, before I hit the ground, I could hear cheering. And who the heck is cheering in the middle of Germany? And I just about landed in a German prisoner of war camp that held English prisoners. And luckily, a guard from this camp come running out of the camp and made the civilians stop shooting me. They had their rifles already aimed at me, and so they stopped shooting. And the guard gathered me up and took me into this camp, and the English prisoners of war gave us tea and crumpets. It was really something. Four members of my crew were not that lucky. They landed too far away for this soldier to save them, and they were killed by the German civilians. And they later paid for it when the GIs came in, and they had a trial, and I have the names of all the soldiers that did that, and I think they were executed for doing that.
Well, that's understandable, and I'm just struck. We talk about close calls, and you've already described a couple close calls in the air, but here, out of just the sheer chance of the order in which you get out of the airplane and where you come down, you could have been killed by angry German civilians. Instead, you landed where you were safe.
Yes, it was really safe. Then I did notice when I got down that my parachute was fastened on both sides. And I don't know, I had some help there.
So you have no idea how that other side got fastened?
No, it was done.
Well, you talk about somebody looking out for you. That's a pretty clear indication. But that said, while you didn't suffer the fate that your crewmates did suffer, it was no picnic what you did endure. Where did they take you, and how were you treated?
Well, the SS takes you first to interrogation, and they're the worst of all the German soldiers. The Luftwaffe soldiers were treated us well, but the SS was terrible. And we were taken to a schoolhouse. It was a pretty big battle that day. A lot of planes shot down, and we filled the schoolhouse with about 8 to 10 flyers, and two of them were shot really bad. And we tried to help them as much as we could, but the Germans would give them no help for the first 2 or 3 days. And we were in this schoolhouse, all of us together, and an incident happened there that I'll never forget. The soldier guarding us, he was a Wehrmacht soldier. He wasn't real bad. And he left to fill up his canteen with water once and left us there. And he locked the door and everything, but he left us by ourselves. And luckily, or unlucky for him, he was eating his lunch at the time. And when he got back, his lunch had disappeared. He says, "Who's ate my lunch?" And nobody said a word. But at least we had a little snack there.
And you didn't have to pay any punishment for that?
No, the German guard, they were halfway civilized. We were gone the next day. The Luftwaffe took us in for integration. They wanted to interrogate us and see where we were from and all that. And then they threatened to keep us until we told them where we were from and what we were bombing and everything. And we knew that all we had to tell them was name, rank, and serial number. And you tell them that, and that was it. And they were going to keep me in there for this cell we went to, had a single cell. And we were going to have to stay there until we told them that. And they had an air raid that day on the town. I think it was Regensburg or something. And I watched this air raid from my cell window, the bars, and it was quite a sight. You know, I was a 19-year-old second lieutenant, and I nothing I could tell them that they didn't already know. And so I was only there 2 days. And then they sent me to Stalag Luft 3, which was the permanent camp for American officers. There was quite a movie made about Stalag Luft 3.
And that's one of my favorites, The Great Escape. What a classic that is.
When I arrived at the camp, I realized that the camp was ran like an army base. We had a colonel was the head of our base, and it was run very strict. If you wanted to escape, you had to go to the escape committee and tell them your plans and everything and wait. But not many people tried that because it was pretty well guarded.
And what were the conditions like there at Stalag Luft 3 in terms of what you had to eat, how your, you know, existence was? Did you lose a lot of weight? What was that ordeal like?
Yes, it was something that was expected, I think. The Germans had no food to give you. The American Red Cross served us what we call parcels, and we were supposed to have one parcel a week. Well, we were on half partials, a half partial a week, and later, after the war, we found out that the Germans had the other half. But we got by with that. Breakfast would be a slice of German bread. It was sliced about an eighth of an inch thick, but it was very heavy. It had a lot of sawdust in it. In fact, I learned later the recipe, they called it sawdust.
Tree flour? I've heard tree flour before, too.
Tree flour, that was it. There's tree flour, and the bottom of the loaves had, you could see the sawdust in them. But it was very filling. And then at noon, we'd have part of the Red Cross parcel had Spam in it. And we'd try and have a slice of Spam with the piece of bread. Sometimes the Germans would serve us soup, and their soup was a real stretching the name of soup. If you had sauerkraut, it was the sauerkraut that had been boiled and all the goodies taken out of it, and they served you what was left. And vegetable soup was the same way. It would help fill you up. Then at night we'd have part of the Red Cross food. It might have been Spam and cheese and the chocolate bar. And they did serve, had coffee in it too.
And I've seen the pictures of you, and today you're a tall man, and back then you're the tallest guy in your crew and a big strapping Southern California teenager. How much weight do you think you lost in captivity, and was it unnerving to see yourself kind of go through that?
No, actually I didn't notice it. I knew I lost a lot of weight. I think I was 160 pounds. Today I'm at 200. When I got home, I started gaining weight. When we got out of the service, we were in hospital rations for quite a while before they let us eat anything. And I'll tell you a little bit about that later.
All right. Well, we'll take a quick break. And when we come back, more about the prisoner of war experience of Dean Whitaker, including his liberation and the famous American general that he would encounter. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. The time always goes by way too fast, and I think that's the case again today with Dean Whitaker, but we'll try to get the most important parts of his story in here for you. If you're just joining the show, Dean lives in Las Vegas. He's originally from Maywood, California. That's in Southern California. He's 86 years old, served in the 398th Bomb Group in World War II. And when we left off, he was telling us about his captivity as a prisoner of war at Stalag Luft 3. Now, it was around Christmas time, and I imagine it wasn't very warm. It was probably kind of hard to stay warm there in the camp, too, huh?
Oh, yes. You know, I had never spent a winter out of Southern California. This was my first winter in the snow, and there was a lot of snow. It was a bad spell of snow right then. When the Russians were getting close to us, we could hear their gunfire, and we didn't know what was going to happen at that Christmas, and so everything was kind of quiet. When we moved out, they told us, well, you can take anything you can carry. And I didn't have anything to carry, but some of the guys had been in there for a couple of years, and they had accumulated quite a bit of stuff. So when we moved out, I built me a kind of a knapsack out of an old sweater, and what really saved us was our GI overcoats. They were our main stay in keeping warm. And so we gathered together what we wanted to take with us, and some of the fellows were throwing away a lot of stuff, of course. They couldn't carry it, and I picked out a bottle of vitamins and a box of prunes and a box of cigars that I could carry. Everything was fairly light. The cigars were like money. you'd trade those to anybody that didn't weigh anything. So I thought, boy, that'd be a good trader. And they did. I traded a lot of cigars for food on that march. And anyway, we marched out there that morning. We were marching on the road to go south to Regensburg, I think, was the target south. And we're going along this highway, and of course the snow was banked up on each side, and you couldn't escape. There's no place to go. And we had the Germans, old soldiers were guarding us. All the young soldiers were still at the front, I guess. And these old soldiers were having a heck of a time carrying their rifles. They would be up on a little bank alongside of us, and one old soldier was guarding us was dragging his rifle. And so one of our men got up there and carried his rifle for him. And the German thanked him for that. Because you couldn't escape. There's no place. But we'd stop at different farms and have bread and soup.
And how long did this march go on? How many days and how many miles?
It went on for 10 days. And then we got to a city, and they loaded us into boxcars to take us the rest of the way.
For those 10 days, where did you sleep? How did you stay warm? How did you survive? Because this is the same time. I mean, we're talking about December 1944. People know the Battle of the Bulge was going on and how horrible that winter was, and that's not too far away. So, I mean, these are some pretty extreme conditions you're dealing with.
Yes, we would sleep in a farm every night that gets a barn, and we'd sleep in the hay. And in the morning, you'd wonder who was in the hay with you, because you couldn't see anybody. You're covered up with hay. And we just managed to keep warm.
So then after 10 days, they put you on 40 and 8s and took you to another camp.
Yes, we got in these 48s, and they were so crowded you had to stand. There was no room to sit. There was a few guys who were pretty sick, and we'd make room for them to lay down. One occasion, it was Christmas time, and somebody started singing Silent Night. The whole train caught on to that, and you could hear a trainload of GIs singing Silent Night.
Something tells me that each Christmas now, when you hear that song, you probably go back to that 40 and 8.
Yeah, that's true. It sure reminds you of that occasion, because it was really hard sleeping in those cars, standing up. And I think we were relieved two times, to get out and go to the bathroom, and in those 2 days or 3 days on that train. I don't recall just exactly, but it was an ordeal.
So it was probably a relief when you arrived at your next destination, even though you were a prisoner there.
Yes, we crossed the Danube, I believe it was, and then this got little town of Moosburg. It wasn't a city, it was a town, and we marched through that town, and all the German civilians were hanging out of their window with a swastika. Later on, after we were liberated, we walked by that same town, and all the white flags were out.
That's a sharp contrast, and a very good one on the second half of that. So at this new prison camp, were the conditions the same? Were they worse? And had your morale been impacted at all by all this that you've been through?
No, it was worse. The facilities were bad. We had no place to sleep. They had put up some temporary tents. And the first night, we slept in an old barn that had so many leaks in it. And I tried to find a place to sleep that wasn't getting dripped on. Couldn't find it. Everything leaked. But the next day, they took us into temporary tents. And this was so crowded. When you slept, you had to sleep on the floor, and everybody was sleeping on the floor, and there was no room. If you had to get up at night, you had to walk over all these bodies. Unluckily, I had dysentery at the time and had to get up a few times during the night. But this dysentery enabled me to go into sick call, which was a permanent barracks that was run by a pre-med student, an Air Force captain. So he treated me, and I'll tell you a little story about him now. On our liberation, well, the first day we saw this infantry spotter planes coming over and knew they were spotting for the artillery. They sighted us and knew we were there. So I think there was 5,000 American officers in this camp. The next morning, we could hear the tanks. They were really making a lot of noise, rumbling. And every once in a while, they'd shoot some. The Germans, was broken up into the Luftwaffe guards who treated us decently and SS troops that were guarding us. Two different type individuals. When they heard the tanks coming, the Luftwaffe soldiers wanted to surrender to us. And they started coming into our camp. There was a road leading to our camp from a cheese plant next to us. And the SS troops started shooting their own soldiers that were coming into our camp. And the road coming into the camp, you could see the bodies of a few of them. And they were shooting up our camp, too. And I got into a slit trench we had built, trying to get protected from the shots being fired into our camp. And one of the shots missed me about 12 inches, I guess. It hit the reeds that were supporting this slit trench. As soon as the tanks saw the shooting from this tower, they shot it. And boy, that tire just blew to pieces by the tanks' guns. All right, then that was in the morning. As soon as everything was cleared out, the tanks came into camp. I have a picture of the soldier, the infantryman, shooting the lock off of the gate to the camp. And behind him came the tanks. Were we ever glad to see them? Then, I don't know what the time was, and then a little bit later, after the tanks, General Patton came in with the tanks. I was in sick bay, which was in the first building, and I was standing at the stoop waiting to greet them. I didn't know he was coming, but he came over to the stoop, to the camp, to the door where I was, and asked me, he says, "How you doing, son?" I says, "Fine now that you're here, General." Well, he was there to see his son-in-law, the medic I was telling you about. It was his son-in-law. His son-in-law got hit by one of these stray bullets, but luckily it had gone through the building and it's pretty well spent. They did carry him out, but he was fine. And so General Patton took him with them and disappeared. Another thing that was quite an occasion for a lot of people, one of the captains on the infantry that liberated us, his brother was in our camp, in the tent, and he was going to really treat him. He took him out and shot a deer, brought the deer back, and was going to really treat the guys in that tent for venison dinner. Well, we all got sick. It was just too strong. We didn't eat much of it, but what there was, we were not used to that. So there was another occasion where that afternoon, a donut truck came in, a Red Cross donut truck, if you can imagine that. They didn't have any donuts. You know, we tried to bum some donuts. Oh, no, we already gave away. But one of the Red Cross workers in the donut truck, her husband was in camp, and you should see the reunion.
And I'm sure when you watched those reunions, you imagined your own.
Oh, yeah, we were ready for that. They were real careful not to give us anything to eat that was going to bother us. We had bread and soup. It took about 10 days for them to get ready to fly us out. They took us by truck to an airport, went by some of the concentration camps, and we saw the prisoners in their striped suits just mulling in the streets, wondering what they were going to do. We went to this airport, old Luftwaffe airport, and we were sitting there waiting for our planes to take us to France. German plane came in and landed. I think it was an ME-109. We watched him land, and he got out, and this woman got out with him. He escaped from the Russians, brought his wife, and landed in there for the Americans to take him prisoner.
It gives you a sense of the desperate times that you were living in. And I look at your wall here in your home in Las Vegas, and you have a very well-preserved and document, the docket with German text and a picture of a young American POW with his fingerprint. How did you come to possess that paper from the German files that documented your captivity?
When the war is over, we could do pretty well what we want. I went to the headquarters of the Luftwaffe there And it was in all a mess, you know. They'd taken all the files and scattered them over. Well, I found this German ID on the floor, a picture of me. It was my ID. And I thought, gee, I'm going to keep that. So I did. I still have it today. The writing isn't German. I can't understand it. But the picture is me.
No doubt about it. And they spelled your name right. When you see that on your wall, and it's not too far from your Purple Heart or your Caterpillar Club for bailing out of an airplane, the wings that you wore, and a picture of your crew. But when you see that picture of you as a prisoner of war, what does it mean to you? Does it trigger something in your mind? Does it have a significance to you when you look at that?
Oh, yes, it sure does. It just reminds me how fortunate I was to escape that and to live a nice life afterwards.
When you came home, and I know you sailed into New York Harbor, and I've heard a lot of people talk about what the Statue of Liberty meant to them at that point, but did you feel you had a new lease on life or a new outlook, a new determination to do something with your life that you almost lost?
Yes, yeah, I just turned 20 in the prison camp, and I always thought that I had a good future, and I wanted to be an architect. And so I was ready to go to school. When we went through New York Harbor and the fireboat come out and sprayed and really celebrated, I felt, well, we're home.
And you would end up back in California. A girl named Lucille caught your eye?
Yes. I was going to church one day, and Lucille, my future wife, was there. And she had lost a boyfriend. Was in the Air Force, and his plane got shot down. It blew up. Nobody escaped. Well, they'd have prisoner of war meetings and missing in action meetings in Los Angeles, and my mother would go, and Lucille would go to see if they'd heard from her ex-boyfriend, and so they got acquainted. So when I came home, Mom said, "You got to meet this young girl. She's really something." And so I did, and met her and married her.
And I guess I skipped over your reunion with your family. And they probably for years, well, at least for 6 months, had been not knowing if you would come back, had gotten telegrams and didn't know what your fate would be. What was that moment like when you got back and saw your family again?
Oh, it was really nice. I had three uncles that worked for the Pacific Electric in L.A. All three uncles were there with my mother and my sister and my brothers to greet me at the railroad station, and it was quite an occasion.
And you talked about meeting Lucille and marrying Lucille, and I've seen your wedding picture, and that beautiful white dress that she's wearing had a unique source of fabric.
Yeah, she wasn't able to get a wedding dress then. There was no cotton or anything, and everybody's getting married, it seemed. And she's going to have to wait a year. But there's this retail house in Bell that was selling old parachutes. And so she got one of her friend's mother to make her a dress out of this silk material from a parachute. It turned out really beautiful, but this parachute came from Cole of California that made bathing suits before the war. My mother worked for him. She probably had something to do with the parachute, I imagine.
Well, and so on November 2nd, 1944, a parachute saved your life, and then when you got married, I guess a parachute helped make your life a little happier.
Yeah, it really did. You got it's weird how things turn out, you know, but everything turned out so well for me, and I have our God to thank.
How many children and grandchildren?
I have two sons that are doing well, and I have five grandchildren that are all healthy. I think that life has been very good for me.
And none of them would have ever been born if you did not survive your captivity.
That's right. It's weird how things turn out, but it seems like they turn out for the best.
When you look back on all of it, everything that you went through, and I know we barely scratched the surface of how difficult it was at times for you, was there anything that you felt gave you strength, or was there one thing you learned through it, one thing that you thought was crucial to your making it through everything you endured?
Yes, I thought the attitude that you had, like me, a young kid that knew that somebody had to escape and it might be you, because the odds of flying with the Air Force were against you. We would lose, on average, one airplane a mission. And there's 36 planes in a group. So that means you're going to fly at 36 missions, you're going to lose 36 planes. You had to fly 30 missions before you could be eligible to come home. So the odds were against you. But I did feel that I was had things to do in this life and that I was going to give the opportunity to do them.
Well, and I'm glad that you did, and I can tell that you made the most of it. Dean, thank you so much for serving our country, and thanks for telling me a little bit about it.
Oh, you're sure welcome, Paul, and I appreciate the work that you're doing here. A lot of the veterans are forgotten today, and I think that they should know something about what went on with them.
No doubt about it. That's why we're here. And thanks to Dean Whitaker of Las Vegas. He's our guest today. If you missed part of the program, you can go online and hear the whole thing at kmjnow.com. And we'll be back next week with another edition here of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.